from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Monday saw a flurry of condemnation for Israel at a UN Commission of Inquiry on Gaza. It was the 45th meeting of the 28th regular session of the Human Rights Council, which opened with an oral report from Mary McGowan Davis, chair of the Commission of Inquiry on Gaza, who covered the 2014 Gaza conflict.
As chair of the Independent Commission of Inquiry on the 2014 Gaza conflict, I am pleased to provide this oral update on the implementation of Human Rights Council Resolution S21/1 on behalf of the Commission of Inquiry. The resolution tasked us to investigate all alleged violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, particularly in the occupied Gaza Strip, in the context of the military operations conducted since 13 June 2014, whether before, during, or after, to establish the facts and circumstances of such violations and of the crimes perpetrated, and to identify those responsible, to make recommendations, in particular on accountability measures, all with a view to avoiding and ending impunity and ensuring that those responsible are held accountable, and on ways and means to protect civilians against any further assaults, and to report to the Council at its 28th session. The Commission has interpreted its mandate as including investigation of the activities of Palestinian armed groups in Gaza, including attacks on Israel, as well as the Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip and Israeli actions in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. The Commission is looking at a broad range of alleged violations committed by all parties and is considering the full range of human rights, including economic, social, and cultural rights. Three commissioners were appointed in August 2014, and the Secretariat was fully staffed by the end of November 2014. The chair of the Commission, Professor William Chabas, resigned last month, and I was appointed chair in his place, serving alongside my esteemed colleague, Dr. Dudu Jen. The Commission made an initial call for submissions with a deadline of 10 January 2015. This deadline was extended until the end of January 2015, and then again until late February, in order to give all stakeholders the opportunity to provide any information they wish to share with the Commission. The Commission has done its utmost to obtain access to Israel and the Gaza Strip, as well as to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. We would very much have liked to meet face-to-face with victims and the authorities in these places. In October and November 2014, the Commission wrote to the government of Israel requesting access. We wrote again in January and February this year, but to date we have received no response to our letters. In November 2014, the Commission wrote to the government of Egypt, requesting access to Gaza via the Rafah crossing. Egypt indicated it was ready to facilitate our travel to Gaza as soon as the security situation permitted travel through its territory. Unfortunately, that has not yet been possible, but we remain ready to go should circumstances change. The Commission is grateful to the government of Jordan for facilitating two missions in November 2014 and January 2015 to Amman, where we met with witnesses and officials from the region. The Commission of Inquiry has used technology to interview a wide spectrum of witnesses and victims in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Many witnesses and NGOs have also traveled here to Geneva to testify before the Commission. In addition, we have received a large number of submissions from individuals, as well as from local and international human rights groups and UN agencies. We are extremely grateful for this cooperation. On the 9th of March, we asked the Council to extend our mandate until June of this year. We need more time in order to assess the large amount of information we have accumulated, much of which has only been received in recent weeks after the extensions of the deadline for submissions. In addition, there are complex legal issues to consider. This process cannot be rushed. Finally, the Commission would like to reassure the victims and witnesses who have testified before the Commission that we remain committed to this process and intend to do justice to their submissions. We look forward to submitting our report to the Council in June of this year. Thank you very much.
After the presentation by the Inquiry Commission Chair, various delegates condemned what they called the brutal, relentless, and indiscriminate attacks by Israel in Gaza in July and August of last year, which caused the death of nearly 2,300 Palestinians, and in which the primary victims were children. The speakers shared deep concerns about the excessive use of force by Israeli security forces in the West Bank, including the arrest and prosecution of nearly 8,000 Palestinian children by Israeli military forces. Also challenged were the 7-year-long illegal blockade of Gaza and the brutal attacks which caused its residents to live in a constant state of humanitarian crisis. Speakers said it was questionable whether Gaza would be a livable place by the year 2020 and said the international community must take this horrifying fact into consideration. Most stressed the need to address daily human rights violations and ensure accountability for the systemic violations of human rights and international law by Israel as the occupying power. Among the report's recommendations, an urgent end to the blockade of Gaza, in accordance with Security Council Resolution 1860 of 2009, which it said constitutes a form of collective punishment with a disproportionate impact on the lives of innocent civilians and children, an immediate cessation of the ill-treatment and abuse of children in detention, including the practice of putting children in solitary confinement, and compliance with other UN Security Council resolutions. Protests last Thursday in Ecuador after the government imposed a series of tariffs on imported goods intended to protect domestic industries, foster industrial and agricultural development, and create jobs. A mobilization of the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador joined with various right-wing opposition groups to challenge the government to President Rafael Correa. Telesur's Liz Sherpias filed this report from Ecuador's capital, Quito.
This is the first fair of Ours First, uniting over 200 producers from across the country in Independence Plaza. Selling clothing, food items, toys, and other goods, these producers see the recently imposed tariff surcharges on some 2,800 imported goods as an opportunity to strengthen national production. These safeguards have been implemented to protect the national economy against the low international price of oil and appreciation of the dollar.
First of all, our president put forward a good initiative to strengthen our Ecuadorian products. These measures will help my product, which is from a rural community and can now be sold all over Ecuador. And it is possible for it to one day be exported.
Happening at the same time as the production fair was a march convoked by the leaders of the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, known as CONAI, joining various opposition groups with distinct demands. Common ground for many present at the march were the safeguards, which put a 5% to 45% increase on taxes on selected imported goods.
I think the safeguards go against our freedom as consumers, because people have the right to decide what to buy and what not to buy.
Opposition groups ranging from trade unions to divided indigenous organizations were present at the march. Many of the demonstrators were against the safeguards and expressed their desire for a change in government.
Lo que pasa es que aquí tenemos una derecha que está financiando movilizaciones de los trabajadores.
What's happening here is that we have the right wing which is financing these worker marches. The workers that are marching right now, these are the people that have been tricked. They've been tricked, they're misinformed. The topic of the safeguards, for example, is something that's going to benefit the people. This is going to benefit us because it allows us to develop national production instead of our money going outside the country. Money will be circulating nationally, and this will allow for job creation and will help the country.
O sea, el dinero va a circular aquí mismo y eso va a permitir pues el desarrollo de fuentes de empleo para la gente porque va a ser mucho mejor para el país, me parece.
In a separate mobilization, protesters made their presence known in front of the headquarters of the ruling party PAIS Alliance, voicing their demands and showing their opposition to the government of President Rafael Correa.
During his weekly presidential address, President Correa mentioned the CIA while talking about the marches that took place last Thursday. According to the French news agency Agence France-Presse, the president said the CIA had infiltrated the opposition-led protests against measures to protect the local economy by placing tariffs on imports. However, on his Twitter account, Correa challenged the news agency's account. He wrote, quote, "If opposition marches had been organized by the CIA, there wouldn't have been such colossal failures," closed quote. A recent international survey conducted by the Association of Political Communication found that President Correa enjoys a 79% approval rating, making him the world's second most popular leader after Russia's President Vladimir Putin, who enjoys favorable ratings in his country in excess of 80%. There is a history of U.S. CIA involvement in Ecuador. In 1963, the agency led a military coup against the left-wing president Carlos Julio Arosmena Monroy after he criticized the U.S. government and showed support for Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba. And in 2013, the Ecuadorian news agency Andes reported that the CIA was planning to murder Correa and destabilize the country in retaliation for his removal of a U.S. military base in 2009, as well as his decision to grant asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Correa had offered to reopen the U.S. base if the U.S. would permit Ecuador to open a military base in Florida. Meanwhile, Ecuador is playing host to foreign ministers from the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC, who gathered in Quito Monday in order to analyze the five-year agenda proposed by Ecuador, which assumed the presidency over the regional bloc earlier this year. According to Ecuador's Vice Foreign Minister, Leonardo Arizaga, the purpose of the meeting is to analyze objectives planned for the next five-year period, which will include goals in the area of poverty reduction and innovation, infrastructure, and in the areas of science and technology. CELAC was created in December of 2011 in Caracas, Venezuela. It consists of the 33 Latin American and Caribbean countries, which represent about 600 million people. The bloc is part of a decade-long push for deeper integration within the Americas, excluding the United States, Canada, and the territories of France, the Netherlands, Denmark, and the UK. It was created to deepen regional integration and to reduce the influence of the U.S. on politics and economics in Latin America. Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Berlin Monday to discuss their respective positions on austerity and to reaffirm a mutual goal of keeping Greece in the Eurozone. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
In a letter to Merkel ahead of the visit, Tsipras has warned that Athens will not be able to service its debt without financial help from the EU. Meanwhile, the Spanish economy minister, Luis de Guindos, has said that Greece will not receive money from the Eurozone Rescue Fund until it implements all of its proposed reforms. The statement has sent jitters across the debt-racked country. The $7 billion tranche of aid was pledged following lengthy talks between Tsipras and other European leaders in Brussels. Greece has been grappling with its worst economic recession since World War II.
A special envoy representing Russia's president met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Vladimir Putin's special envoy, Azamatullah Kolmohammadov, reviewed efforts being led by Moscow to hold a second round of talks on the Syrian crisis in April. We have this report from Press TV.
Assad said a mechanism is needed to ensure the success of a dialogue between different factions. He also hailed Moscow's efforts in finding a solution to the crisis and said Damascus's complete trust in the Russian leadership. Assad and Kolmohammadov, however, stressed that the success of any political process depends on international pressure on countries supporting the terrorist groups in Syria. In February 2014, Russia hosted the first round of talks on Syria, which ended without any concrete results.
The U.S. Supreme Court Monday refused to hear a challenge to a Wisconsin law that requires would-be voters to provide photo ID before casting their ballots. According to the New York Times, the move was a surprise, since the court last year had temporarily blocked the law for the November 2014 election. Upon learning of the court's action, the ACLU immediately filed an emergency application in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit for a stay, saying it was needed to prevent a sudden change in requirements for an April general election where voters will elect judges, a mayor, and other local officials. Dale Ho, director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project, said in a statement, quote, "The situation is even more compelling here because absentee ballots have already been mailed out for the April election and early in-person voting has begun. Imposing a new restriction in the midst of an election will disenfranchise voters who have already cast their ballots. It is a recipe for disaster," closed quote. 2 weeks after U.S. President Barack Obama signed an executive order declaring that Venezuela constituted a threat to U.S. national security, a petition drive that began in Venezuela and has spread around the globe calling on the president to revoke his declaration garnered, as of Monday morning, more than 2.5 million signatures. President Obama's declaration has also provoked a massive show of solidarity across Latin America and the Caribbean that transcends political ideology and national boundaries. For more, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Nicaragua's capital, Managua.
I think it was on, when was it, Tuesday or Wednesday of this last week, the heads of ALBA, the heads of state of the ALBA countries, which now includes, I think it's five Caribbean countries, Antigua and Barbuda, Dominica, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Santa Lucia, and I think Grenada now as well, as well as Ecuador, Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Nicaragua. They held an extraordinary summit to come to a common position in response to, formally, in terms of the ALBA bloc, in response to this extraordinarily maladroit decree by President Barack Obama that has only served to antagonize further the countries that have always been very suspicious of Barack Obama's protestations of goodwill towards Latin America and the Caribbean ever since we remember back in 2009, Barack Obama was received with much optimism and warmth by the countries of Latin America in the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago that year. And just a month or two afterwards, the United States was largely responsible for the military coup that took place against President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras. From that point on, especially the ALBA countries, but not only the ALBA countries, have been very wary about how seriously to take President Obama's protestations of goodwill towards Latin America. And with this latest decree declaring Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, Barack Obama has tipped that suspicion over into outright, perhaps not hostility, but certainly antagonism. Because one of the interesting things about the declaration that came out of that 11th extraordinary summit is that it's very clear that from the tone of the declaration, as well as the actual text, that the ALBA countries are committed to facilitating dialogue between Venezuela and the United States. But it's a dialogue that has to be on terms of respect for the sovereignty and legitimacy, the sovereignty of Venezuela as a country and the legitimacy of the government of President Nicolas Maduro as the freely elected government of the country. And the ALBA countries make very clear that whereas they themselves may not be acceptable to the United States as intermediaries for that dialogue, and they're fully prepared to promote dialogue through mechanisms like the Union of South American States and the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC.
Right. And UNASUR also issued a declaration of solidarity with Venezuela, by the way, and that's an even broader organization. That's everyone except for U.S. and Canada, Mexico, and a couple of colonies, right?
Yeah, and both UNASUR and the ALBA countries and all the Latin American states are determined to insist that Latin America is a zone of peace, and that while there may be disagreements between the countries within the region, and they're determined that those conflicts be resolved in a peaceful way. And the whole tone of Barack Obama's decree is one that very clearly seems to be intended to create the conditions for some kind of military intervention or some kind of ratification of a coup d'etat.
On June 14th, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction was finally overturned by a federal court, turned himself in to go back to prison to begin serving again a sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. In this fifth installment of the investigation into his case, we discuss the fact that, despite numerous pleadings supported by massive amounts of evidence of his actual innocence of the charges for which he's been imprisoned for most of the last past 20 years, Lorenzo has to appear in court this coming Friday, not to argue for his freedom, but to testify in a hearing where the state is seeking to disqualify his co-defendant's lawyer on technical grounds. We spoke about that and about some of the difficulties he faces in his everyday life as one of the more than 2 million residents of America's prison industrial system. He spoke with us by telephone from the Mahanoy, PA State Correctional Facility in which he is imprisoned Sunday.
Friday, we have a hearing in front of my trial judge, Todd Hoover, in the Dauphin County Courthouse in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, at 10 o'clock. And this hearing is not, you know, for my innocence or any of my claims. This hearing is for the prosecution is trying to disqualify my co-defendant, Corey Walker's attorney, Rachel Wolkenstein. I'm being called down to testify, I guess, to my communication with Ms. Wolkenstein concerning, you know, I don't know everything that's going to come out, but I know one thing that's not going to be talked about is my innocence and Corey's innocence. So, you know, it's you know, a delay tactic as usual. You know, right now we have an actual innocence appeal that's been sitting in front of my trial judge going on 3 years now, and it has been amended 3 times with newly discovered evidence that we never had for 19 years that was taken by the prosecution. Right after the hearing this week, we should be getting ready to get court dates for, you know, following hearings concerning these issues.
That's good. Meanwhile, you had company today, what's it like in your average day? I mean, today you had company. Most days you don't. What's that like? What does it mean when somebody comes to visit you? And, you know, where the hell are you exactly and all of that?
It's a huge source of energy, number one. You know, number two, my day consists of, you know, waking up, going to law library or to the yard. You know, I go work out in the gym, you know, 5-6 days a week. And I do a lot of writing. Like, you know, I got a lot of people that write me, and I try to stay in touch with everybody, and I write articles at least twice a week on wrongful convictions. And it's crazy because, you know, it's all type of stuff going on behind these walls. You know, it's like the streets but with bars. Everything that's going on out there is going on in a different form here. So, you know, not only I have to maintain my safety, you know, physically and mentally, is that, you know, I got to stay focused on, you know, getting back to my family because I don't supposed to be here.
Yeah, right.
So it's like I'm like, and then being in Pennsylvania with no family, all my family's in New York, it's like I'm on another planet out here in Pennsylvania, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like a whole bunch of unfamiliar faces that, you know, you get to know over the weeks, months, years.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And, you know, a visit, you know, it brings energy like no other. Like, you know, you see your family and friends such as, you know, my brother Tyrone, my wife Taza, you know, Jeffrey Jesovich, who's like, you know, one of my best friends and one of my biggest advocates because, you know, the Jeffrey Jesovich Foundation also, you know, is a part of my legal team, you know?
Right.
So it's like, you know, speaking to them today, you know, I haven't seen Jeffrey in a couple months, but, you know, we talk all week, you know? And so, you know, it's like keeping me in a loop. And, like, before I came home before from the first 16 and a half, it's like my body's just here. You know, my mind, everything that's going on is on the street. Like, you know, my body's just here. So I never look through my eyes as a lifer because I know I'll be getting out of here. It's just that I don't know exactly when.
Right. Let me ask also about that. This is a Pennsylvania prison. Are most of the folks that are in there from like Philly and Pittsburgh, I guess?
Yeah.
So and how
majority
close?
Majority of people from Philadelphia, then second is Pittsburgh.
And how close is it to Philadelphia or Pittsburgh physically? How close is
how
it?
How close this prison is?
Yeah.
This prison is probably an hour and a half from Philadelphia and probably 4 to 5 hours away from Pittsburgh.
So and what's the transportation like? Is it difficult for families to come visit?
Oh, yeah, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes away from New York. And this is the first time I've been this close to New York in a prison. Like, you know, this is my seventh prison, and the majority of the prisons I was at was six and a half to 8 hours away from New York. So it was extremely difficult to maintain the family ties as far as visits and stuff like that.
Hmm. And I guess that's a situation for most of the folks in there if they're that far away from Philly and Pittsburgh.
Exactly. You know, they got, like, today, it was a bus that was on a visit that came from Pittsburgh. Like, once a month, a charter bus will come from Pittsburgh with families to come down here to see, you know, their friends, family members, or whoever that's here. And, you know, that'll pack the visits. So, you know, other people, visits will be terminated because they give courtesy of the people that's coming from the other side of the state, you know?
Mm. So they ration visits, basically.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. And what's some of the other things that you have to look at, that you have to endure outside of, you know, people know what they see in movies about what it's like to be in prison, but what are some of the, you know, the daily, I don't know, annoyances that you have to put up with?
It's really, you know, you see, like, me, I'm over the 19-year mark, and I see guys go home, come back, you know, not only on violations, but I see guys that come back to prison with new charges and stuff like that. And, you know, us innocent prisoners, we fighting so hard to be vindicated because we don't supposed to be here. And we constantly see guys come back, you know, constantly, rotation, come back. And then you get to see a lot of different aspects from it. You see guys that is here that got all their programs completed, and the parole won't let them go. You know, then you got guys that come back to prison with violations and been sitting for simple violations with no new charges for 3 and 4 years. It's like unheard of out here with that. And then, you know, you look at the mass incarceration, like that's a part of it. Like, you know, if a man got his programs in and got the recommendation from the jail, you should be able to, you know, go home to your family. Your sentence is complete. It's not necessarily like that here, you know.
Mm.
And the more and more now you see life sentences is like, you know, remember the war on drugs? Now it's like everybody's like life sentences is common. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, life is naturally nice. It's not like New York where 15, 20 years you see the board. That's not the case out here.
Life means they take you out in a box.
Exactly.
So, I guess by the time we speak next week, you'll have done this court date and have tried to get some kind of an idea of what angle they're trying to play in your co-defendant's case. And
exactly.
And then hopefully that means that they'll start tracking your case at this point.
Yeah, I mean, right after this, everything should start kicking in, but if anybody that's in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area and can make it to this hearing to see actually what's going on, you know, I would like for them to come and see what's going on for themselves, you know?
What when and where is this? What time and where?
I mean, it's on Friday, the 27th of this month at 10 a.m. in front of Judge Toddie Hoover in the Dauphin County Courthouse in Harrisburg. Go to the website for updates, you know, at thefreelorenzojohnson.org.
We'll have an update on Lorenzo's case for you next week. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.